Okay, so we're gonna start over because our first video went AWOL. So as I was saying, the challenge, the difficulty of the upcoming chapter of Tanya is because since we're based on the verse Kikarev Elecha Adavim Ait, this thing is exceedingly close. It's easy for us to do, and the Alter Rebbe says that the pasuk says not only dibur, not only speech, not only communication, not only we can speak as we should speak, not only we can do as we should do, we can change ourselves. And that is very difficult to understand, especially because the Alter Rebbe introduces the difference between tzaddikim and between beinonim, is that tzaddik is somebody who is never struggling, who finished the struggle, but the beinoni is somebody who ever struggles. He doesn't change himself. And because he doesn't change himself, so then there's that same challenge again and again and again, maybe variegated, it slightly shifts, but ultimately he's dealing with the same challenges constantly. And there's a virtue, something very beautiful about the beinoni's battle. The beinoni's battle is the definition of his life. And the glory is not in victory almost as much as it's in the battle itself. The Beinoni doesn't give up, and the Beinoni has small victories, and he overcomes the Yetzirah here or there, and the Yetzirah keeps coming with new stuff and keeps pushing the Beinoni down. The Tzaddik has gone beyond that. Tzaddik does not have that kind of challenge or issue. He's broken the atmosphere. I was saying, by means of illustration, that I've heard of said that of Nachman Breslover, that the extraordinary quality that he had, or one of the extraordinary qualities, was the fact that he was always battling, even though he was a Tzaddik. Tzaddikim don't battle. Alter Rebbe, when he met him, he said he's a Gibra Chayil. He's a valiant warrior. So, because he wasn't battling a Yetzirah, he killed like every other tzaddik. But he was battling the mental illness, the depression that he dealt with. And that's a battle. So, tzaddikim could destroy the Yetzirah, but the chemical imbalance or issues that they have on a physical level, if a tzaddik has a broken foot, he has a broken foot. It's hard to walk to shul because he has a broken foot. You talk about a person who dealt with depression. Depression is a terrible, terrible, debilitating state of mind. And here's a person who was able to overcome that and reach the highest levels of joy without pharmacology, without therapy, or by himself. It's actually it's an astounding achievement. Anyway, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's just a frame or to illustrate the point. But going back to our Beinoni, the what we've come to understand is that the Beinoni doesn't change himself. The Beinoni can't change himself. Even if he wanted to, he can't, because that's not his nature. He doesn't have these Olympian spiritual abilities. Which presents a problem when we say that it's beficha uvilvavcha, that it's possible to change the way it is belev. And that this is even karev, this is very, very easy. So the question is, how does that work? How do we understand it? The Alter Rebbe explained in the previous chapters, up till the end of chapter 17, the Alter Rebbe says that here's what we can say. A person can experience an emotional kind of connection to Hashem that's not really a pure emotion. Really, the emotion is one that's comprised of the intellect. A person can contemplate deeply, he can put himself into a headspace, and in his mind's eye, he sees with clarity why he should love Hashem, why he should revere Hashem. And because he's in this state of constant memory, he always remembers this. He doesn't have forgetful moments, he doesn't lose it, he's always focused. So because he's in this constant state of focus, and because he understands that that's the way it should be, and because intrinsically the ahava, the love and the fear is part of who we are, so therefore we say that connects to the latent potential that's beneath the surface, and superficially, because he's very involved cerebrally and intellectually, he puts himself into a different space, and as such, that's called an Aveda Tama, that's called a proper Aveda Hashem. So the Alter Rebbe in chapter 18 begins to make a little bit of a turn. Up until this point, we've talked about, in the last two chapters at least, intense intellectual ability and focus. A person really harnesses every ounce of wherewithal of their mind. Alter Rebbe now comes along to explain this latent and this potential love. And he opens the conversation with the word Ma'id. To have a better understanding, to really understand this well, for that is the hallmark of Chabad, to understand things really well, in a foundational sense. Milas Ma'id. This chapter is based more than anything else on that one word. That the Torah says not only it's kariv, not only it's close, but it's Ma'id. It's exceedingly, it's very close. And that word is found in the pasuk of Karev Elecha. So when you have the word very in the same sentence as close, close to you, it means it's very close to you, then that would mean it should be something which is within the easy reach of every person. But not everybody is a genius, and not everybody is capable of exerting themselves cerebrally for hours on end. So it's not fair to say that if it can be accomplished by powers of meditation and contemplation, that that's called karev me'oid to everybody. There are some people that have the ability to meditate and the ability to transport themselves mentally into a different world. There are people who can do this. And by the powers of the intellect, they're able to dominate their matter. It's mind over matter. And it's spirit over form. There are people like this. And it's extraordinary ability. I don't know that it's a holy ability. It's a physical, it's a literal ability. There's some people who are simply very, very capable in this area. Just like there's some people who can train until they jump 30 feet. There are people who can do that. We call them Olympians. It's just a frame, a figure of speech, because that's what we see it. But there are people who can do extraordinary things like that, who can throw a baseball 100 miles an hour, and people who can hit that baseball. That's an amazing achievement. And then there are people who are capable of extraordinary intellectual feats. They can meditate or contemplate on a subject for a very, very long time. And they can actually transport themselves cerebrally in a way which is impressive. They have great powers of mind. So what the Alter Rebbe said before speaks to the idea that a person should be able to accomplish this cerebrally, intellectually, by harnessing the powers of the mind. What's the problem? The problem is that many of us are simple people. We're not capable of this. Here's an extraordinary example of the powers of the mind. Kurt, why don't you join us?
I'm so busy.
This is about Karev Ma'id, being very close. There was a Hasidish Rebbe who actually escaped the Holocaust. He was in New York in the 40s and 50s. His name was the Majitz Rebbe. The Majitz Chassidim are famous for serving Hashem with Negina, with music and song. The famous Chazan in New York, his name was Bitzian Schenker. He produced many albums, all the Majitz and the Gunim, beautiful songs. So the story is told that the Majitz Rebbe had to undergo some kind of surgery. And putting him under a general anesthetic was a scary thing, it was a dangerous thing. So he said, I don't need the anesthetic. It's fine. And he composed something like a 2-hour musical composition. And when he put himself into that headspace of the musical composition, the song that he sang through surgery, he was able to get through the surgery without a general anesthetic. It's like astounding, it's mind-boggling. And I don't know if that's a testament to holiness or righteousness. It wasn't about his righteousness. He had the ability to harness every fiber of his being through the power of music. There are people who can do this. There are people who can work on a composition and they can just lose sight and touch of everything around them and that's become totally immersed until they can put together some kind of brilliant composition. There are such people. There is such a concept. There are people who can think about things for a very long time and analyze things very, very carefully. There are people like that, it's true. But that's not the average person. The average person is not a professor. The average person is not a deep academic. The average person is the average person. So Torah was not given to the clerisy of intellectuals. The Torah was given to every single person. And if it says in the Torah that it's kind of me'id, it's exceedingly close to every person, says the Alter Rebbe, it's tzarich leiden emunah, then we have to understand this. We have to really get a clear grasp of this, because ki af mishadaitik tzara bidias Hashem, even somebody whose mind is, so to speak, limited or short in his knowledge of Hashem, maybe somebody's very smart, but they don't have enough material to think about. Think, what should I think about? He says, just meditate about God. I don't know what that means. I didn't learn enough yet. So, you can't fulfill karev ma'id. Come to yeshiva, learn for 5 years, and then you can become a karev ma'idju. Doesn't say that. It says, it's for everybody. Ki karev alecha davar ma'id. Moshe Rabbeinu is speaking to everybody. Not just to his generation, not just to outstanding people of future generations. And then there are some people who ein loy lev lahavin begdulas ein seif baruch. They don't have the heart to understand, which just seems like an oxymoron. What do you mean that you feel with your heart, you understand with your mind? What does it mean that you don't have the heart to understand? So this has something to do with what we call today emotional quotients. Or there are certain things which can be experienced cerebrally, intellectually. People understand certain things, but understanding things does not change them in any way, shape, or form. Not only does not change them, they don't have the ability to sort of move from the intellectual plane into the emotional plane, to connect to something. An extreme example of this, and I'm only using extreme examples because it helps us understand like the form of caricature. You have people who are brilliant, brilliant computer programmers, but they're on the spectrum of autism. They can't relate. They're socially inept. And you could explain how the social dynamics work, and they can get a degree in political science, and they can get a degree in anthropology, and they're still socially inept. And it doesn't, they don't have that rhythm. Whatever they understand, whatever they know, they can know all about people. They can read an analysis, a thesis analysis of somebody, and they can know everything the Secret Service discovered about him, and they still don't know how to deal with him. They still don't know how to manipulate or get their way or even develop or nurture a healthy relationship. But you have all the knowledge. You have everything it takes, except the wherewithal, because they don't have a lev lahavin. You have to have an understanding heart. You can't just have an understanding mind. And especially because Avodas Hashem is not just what we understand, but also what we feel and what we do. If a person doesn't have a lev lahavin, if a person doesn't have an understanding heart, he's not going to be able to achieve this. L'heilid v'menu, that he should be able to engender, literally to give birth, from the thoughts, the chilu v'rechimu, a sense of love and a sense of awe. So earlier we spoke about, yes, you can change yourself. The tzaddik can, the beinoni can't. It's a big difficulty. It's not simple. Okay, that's fine. But you can do so b'mayach tvunasei. In your mind's eye, you can create this emotion, an intellectual emotion. You can think about it so strongly that it's almost real. You can almost feel it. Well, this guy can't do that. He doesn't have that ability. He doesn't have that unique, let's say, gift of assimilating or translating things from an intellectual plane into an emotional plane. So you're going to call him a stymied individual? Maybe. And maybe when we talk about physical or literal things, it may result in people who have poor social interactions. And there are lots of people like that who are very successful intellectually, but they fail emotionally. It's not uncommon. It doesn't mean somebody's autistic. They just use that as a frame. It just means that these things don't come easy. So Yiddishkeit was only given to people who have a healthy balance, people who are really social. That's, for them, Yiddishkeit will work because they can have a relationship with God. But if you're not really social, forget about it. You can't have a relationship with God. Does that make any sense? Could we say that? For sure not. For sure not. But Alter Rebbe acknowledges that up until the end of chapter 17, the path that he charted is one that requires rigorous intellectual effort and ability. Where does that leave a large swath of the population? Afal Pikein, nonetheless, says the Alter Rebbe, Korev Elov HaDover Me'oid. This is still exceedingly close. The Dover, the thing, what's the thing? The thing is Yiddishkeit. The Yiddishkeit thing is still exceedingly close. And how is it exceedingly close? It's close Lishmer. It's close to keep. You can do this. It's close Lasseis. You can follow through Kol Mitzvah HaTorah. All of the commandments of the Torah, they can be done. The Salmu Torah, Keneged Kulam, the study of Torah, which as the Mishnah tells us, is equal to all of the mitzvahs. And that's really hard for people who don't enjoy intellectual pursuit to study Torah assiduously and diligently when they don't like studying. That's not simple. That's almost unfair. People who like to study, who like to read, if they wouldn't be Jewish or they wouldn't be observant or spiritually involved, they'd be sitting in the library and reading Homer and the Iliad and whatever other books they love, the famous textbooks and the famous works that were written. They would sit and read philosophy. That's their nature. That's it. They're philosophical people. So a person like that, one who has that kind of nature, if he happens to be Jewish and he happens to be brought up in an environment where Torah is revered, so he'll learn a lot of Torah. Great. Okay, that's very nice. What about everybody else? Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam is not written for the intellectuals. It's not written for the tiny percent of the population. It's written for everybody. So then if you're doing all the mitzvahs, it can't just be, I'm a person who's disciplined, which not everybody's disciplined either, I'm a person not just who discipline, who can do things. I'm a person who can sit and study. Talmud Torah connected kula means the study of Torah equals them all. Which doesn't mean that everybody has to study Torah on the same level. Everybody studies Torah as they could. For some people, what's interesting for them is to study the stories of the Gemara. And that's great. That's beautiful. Some people, they enjoy the Chumash. Some people like the Gemara. Everybody finds a different part of Torah that lights his candle. But at Tzad HaShava, the common denominator is that they're all supposed to be involved in Torah study. And it's bilvava, it has to be in the heart, mamash. Me'umka, the liba, in the very depths of the heart, be'emes la'amite. And this is a very key component of the Chabad philosophy, that has to be emes la'amite. The truth is unchanging. Emes la'amite is ever unchanging, or never unchanging, because it's emes la'amite. This is not just a spontaneous moment, a high that comes and then evanescently passes. This is something which is very, very deep and very profound and very much a part of you, to the point that it's always there. You can always live this way. Amito is a permutation of emet. Okay. Emet la amito. The truth in its truth. It's like truth on steroids. Kind of. But doesn't mean that this truth intellectually, that this is bidechilu v'rechimu, that a person is passionately engaged in his Judaism. And passion is really a confluence of both love and awe. There's a sense of balance, a deep sense of respect, and at the same time a sense of love. You want to come close to it. This sounds ridiculous. It sounds like a lot of words, just like saying things which are not practical. But Judaism has to be practical. That was Moshe Rabbeinu's point, that it is practical and every one of us can do this. So what is the answer? What is the answer to all this? How indeed can this be true? Especially as Alter Rebbe is trying to explain it. So his answer is that this can be true and this must be true because there is something that is called the Ahava Musuteris. This is the Ahava, which is the love, which is hidden, Shebelev Klal Yisrael, which is hidden in the heart of each and every single one of us. And this Ahava, which is latent, and it's in a potential state, but it's real, it's in the core essence of the heart, it's tucked away into the folds of our very being. This is something that's found equally in every single heart. Now, this love is called misuteret. Misuteret comes from the word seter. It's hidden. It's mysterious. It's not on the surface. It's not easy to see or discover or know this love, but it's there. And more importantly, it's not something which is engendered through hard work and effort. Because if it's something that I work on, and because I toiled and worked on it, that's why I was able to achieve it. What do you mean it's hidden? It can't be hidden. It was something that was worked on. It was something that I was actively involved with. You're not actively involved with things that are hidden. If you're actively involved is above ground. You say, this is hidden. Well, if it's hidden, then it necessarily has to be something which is there by dint of nature, and it necessarily has to be something which is not created through my efforts. So when we say it's Ava Mesuteres, what we're really talking about something which is engraved on the DNA of the soul. And even when you don't feel this, and even when you don't know it, it's there. So, let's say there's a loving relationship that exists. I'm going to use the example of little children, because little children is the most altruistic kind of relationship. They love their parents without knowing really why. They don't understand that their parents provide everything for them. They just want to please their parents. That's how cute little kids are. Unfortunately, they don't stay cute a little for very long. But when they're very cute and little, they're really loyal, and they just want to please their parents. And as I said, it's not because they thought about this and came to the conclusion that my mom or dad buy me the clothes I need, ensure that I have a roof over my head, and they give me clothing, and then they take me on outings. No, the child just wants to please the parents until he gets wiser than that. So what happens when the child is not actively doing something that's loving for the parents? What happens when the child is, for example, throwing a fit like a brat because you're shopping in the store and they pass the candy And the kid says, could you buy me that candy? And the parent says, no. No, you can't have the candy. Maybe Bubby will buy you the candy. I'm not buying you the candy. And the kid starts to have a tantrum and a fit. And they're yelling and screaming. And they're embarrassing their parents in front of everybody. And the parent's temperature is rising to a boiling point. And the mother storms out of the store and never finishes buying what she has to buy. And let's just say that we're not in a good state. The relationship is not healthy. Kid gets buckled in the car. They drive home in stony silence. And the kid gets sent to the room. You know what I'm talking about. Everybody's had this kind of experience. Okay. So what does that mean? The kid doesn't love the parents anymore? What would you say? No love?
Of course they do.
Huh? Of course they do. Of course they do. So then, why did you see the love? Why? Because it's misuteret. Because it's hidden. That wasn't exactly reasonable when the child had the tantrum. Children are not particularly reasonable. Rhyme and reason is something that comes later on with maturity. So they unreasonably flew into a rage, flew off the handle, went totally bonkers and nuts, and took out the neshama of the parents. And did really, like, you know, just gave them such grief. Can't say they don't love the parents. Right now, they're not focusing on that love. Right now, they flew into a tantrum, which blinded them and made them focus only on the candy, and they don't have the candy, and that's a great sense of sorrow. And 20 minutes later, they slink out of the room, and they come out, and they start crying. Mommy, could you hug me? And whatever. Like, what happened over here? Like, you didn't have this conversation. And then you try to have this conversation. You know, you really shouldn't do that to mommy anymore. Next time you're in the store, if you do that again, the child says, of course, of course, of course. 3 days later, the same thing happens all over again. That's... And usually the only thing that stops it is a really serious punishment where they're really, really going to lose something that they really want and the parents follow through, which almost never happens. When the parents follow through, I read once a story somewhere of a family who had decided to drive down to Florida on holiday and the kids were bickering in the back. And the parents were flipping and the father says, if you guys don't stop bickering, we are going home. We're not going to drive to Florida. And the kids are like, yeah, right. Like they're not saying that, but... And the bickering continues and the father turns around and drives right back to Thornhill and parks the car and they never go to Florida. Wow. And they're grounded for 2 weeks.
Jesus.
They never did it again. Right? But to have that kind of strength, that's unbelievable. I don't have that strength. That's like to follow through with a threat like that, right? But we all make threats and but we don't do it. So the child for sure loves his parents when that happens. Nobody's gonna doubt that. The child also is not behaving in consonance with that love. Comes the question. Where did the love go? The child parked it somewhere for a week. He's going to bring it back. Where did the love go?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What's the answer? It was misuteret. It went underground. It was always there. It was always there. It didn't go anywhere. So what happens? You have a Jew who's angry at God, he's frustrated with God, goes away from God. What happened to the love? You tell me that he has a Ava Misuteres Shebelev Klos Yisrael, which we're really going to analyze in great detail. What happened to that love? What's the answer? It's always there. If it's always there, why is he behaving in such a terrible way? Because it's hidden. Because it's not being utilized. Because it's not being activated. What's the challenge then? Activate it. Bring it forth. This love is a Yerushalanu Maaveseinu. This love is an inheritance. Now, it cannot be something which is a developed achievement or talent because you can't get that biyerusha. You can't get that in an inheritance. If the father or mother are extraordinary musicians, what do you think? The children are by nature extraordinary musicians? You have to work to become an extraordinary musician. Even the most talented musician had to work very hard to become an extraordinary musician. So when you have something that's developed, something which is cultivated, something which is worked on, you cannot pass that on. It's impossible. You can pass on nature. You cannot pass on nurture. Nurture has to happen. So if you were nurtured, or certain things were nurtured within you, if you will nurture those things in your children, you have a chance of inculcating or nurturing it for them. But it will not happen by nature. And if they were taken away from their parents' home, God forbid, and somebody else nurtured them, then they would have a different kind of nature. Now, there's obviously a confluence of nature and nurture, and sometimes we don't know which is more potent or powerful. Both are necessary, that's for sure. We are a composite of nature and nurture. Everybody knows that. It's kind of agreed upon today. So when we talk about something which comes by Yerusha, something which comes by inheritance, we are definitely not talking about nurture. We are certainly talking about nature. Okay, so you're telling me that every single Yid has a love for Hashem. Alter Rebbe said, that's really interesting. But we need to understand this now. Okay, so you're telling me it's possible. Everybody can do this. How can everybody do this? What if I'm not a big intellect? What if I don't have the ability to harness the powers of meditation and thinking? Well, it doesn't matter. You still have the ability to be able to tap into your nature. There's got to be a nature. The word nature, this cannot be nurture if it's a Yerusha. It's an inheritance. So the Alter Rebbe says, okay, we have to understand this then. If we're to make any sense of this, it has to be defined. Actually, we have to explain. To first preface with a really good understanding of what this nature is. What is this inheritance? And after we understand and define and clarify what this inheritance is, then we will be able to perhaps ask the question, so how does that work? How can we actually utilize this in our own life? Number one, the first question is, Shedish Avazu. What's the source? What's the source of this? So I know that a person can nurture it, but the nature, where does it actually come from? So we want to understand that. Once we understand its nature, we'll understand how we can utilize it through nurture. The second thing we have to define is inyana. What is the goal of this ava? What is the purpose of this ava? What is the function of it? What does it accomplish? So people have various desires or goals or aims, and that's why they know that, you know, this faculty, it brings me to here or to there. What is its inyan? What is this all about? Where am I trying to go with this? What's the destination? I also have to understand, how can it be a Yerusha? This doesn't sound like a Yerusha. Feelings generally are nurtured. They're not a product of nature. You're telling me this is a product of nature. How is that possible? How does that work? And finally, all of this, we've talked about love. The question is, love and reverence are two very different emotions. They're not the same at all. I can be reverential towards something, but I have no love for it. I can be loving something and have no reverence whatsoever. And the question is, I have to understand these four details. So we have to understand, again, the source, the shadish, the foundation of this. We have to understand inyana. We have to understand what is this about? What is its goal? What's its purpose? How can something like that be passed on by inheritance, meaning it's a nature? And finally, how does reverence fit into all of this? Because we have dechilu v'rechimu, is the two wings, the right and the left, two wings which enable the bird to, so to speak, take off. So this is what we're going to try to explain, Be'ezras Hashem, as we move forward in our study of chapter 18, Perek Chai, of the Book of Tanya. L'chaim. Yeah.